from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Republican Senator Ben Sasse will join us. His new book is The Vanishing American Adult, Our Coming-of-Age Crisis, and How to Rebuild a Culture of Self-Reliance. Politico's off-message podcast asked Ben Sasse recently whether, by his definition, President Trump is an adult.
He definitely comes from a world to the presidency that comes out of a reality TV world. And, you know, I have lots of anxiety about whether or not that kind of world is really what we want for our kids.
Senator Sasse was one of the most vocal anti-Trump Republicans during the campaign, and he spoke out against the president's firing of FBI Director James Comey, but he strongly supports many of Trump's policies. He'll join us after this. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. Republican Senator Ben Sasse worries that Americans are fast losing the values of discipline and personal integrity. The Nebraska senator wants the American people to resist consumerism and recover a sense of meaning and personal integrity. Senator Sasse outlines ways to achieve this in his new book, The Vanishing American Adult. A first-term senator, he secured all of Nebraska's 93 counties when he won a landslide victory in 2014. Senator Sasse has opposed Donald Trump during the campaign, and he spoke out against the president's firing of FBI Director James Comey, but he strongly supports many of President Trump's policies, including the repeal and replacement of Obamacare, which he has called arguably the worst law in our history. Senator Sasse joins us from the nation's capital to explain his prescription for reviving civic culture and to talk about the news with us. And welcome, Senator Sasse.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. And I just want to say kudos on your book and congratulations on it. As a longtime teacher of American literature, I saw a lot of Emerson's self-reliance ideas in there and a lot of your fellow Nebraskan Willa Cather's values as well. I wanted to go to the news, though, with you first, if we could, because it was just announced that Attorney General Jeff Sessions will testify in open hearing tomorrow at the Senate Intelligence Committee. And House Minority Leader Pelosi says that Sessions should resign. This is amid reports that he may have held a third undisclosed meeting with Russia's ambassador. What do you think? Jeff Sessions told your Senate colleagues repeatedly that he did not have communications with the Russians.
Well, we heard from Jim Comey, the former director of the FBI, last week, or I should say the Senate Intelligence Committee did, and now it's time to hear from the administration. So I'm glad to hear that AG Sessions is coming to the Hill tomorrow. He'll also be in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I'm glad that that's going to be an open session. I think that's important for the public to be able to see that conversation happen in public. You can lead us into particulars, but I would just say at the macro level, we should acknowledge that, you know, we're in the midst of a crisis of public trust. It's much bigger than just the 2016 election, though we need a full look back at what happened in the 2016 election. I think the appointment of Bob Mueller is a good thing that Americans should applaud. But I also think it's critically important that we distinguish between what's happening in the sort of niche devolution of American conversations retrospectively, and we should also recognize what's going to happen prospectively. We have a couple of different things happening at the same time. One of them is more American on American distrust, more doubt that isn't really fundamentally about the political parties. It's about the sort of hollowing out of local community and about a transformation of the way we consume media. And so when you think about what Russia is going to do going forward, they're going to exacerbate this crisis of public trust. They're going to try to extend that, and we need to be sure we can talk about it in ways that don't just start with red versus blue jerseys of who people voted for last cycle.
But should Jeff Sessions resign, in your judgment?
The Attorney General is going to testify before the committee, and I'm sure he's going to get lots of hard questions. He's recused from this investigation, so the bulk of his job isn't connected to this. But obviously, Jim Comey planted some seeds of questions that I'm sure will be asked tomorrow about what he meant when he said he thought that the Attorney General likely would have recused himself earlier. So I look forward to hearing that testimony tomorrow.
Well, you talk about the concern over trust, and now, although you spoke well of Robert Mueller, and so many Republicans have, there have been statements by Newt Gingrich, for example, and others that really seem to be trying to erode, at least, the trust in him. And certainly we're hearing people like Mike Lee, conservative from Utah, Republican senator, saying James Comey probably would not lie under oath. And a number of Republicans are taking that sort of position. They're not going along with President Trump, who, in effect, along with his lawyer, says that Comey did lie under oath. And defenders in your own party are saying that the president's behavior with Comey was inappropriate and naive, but they don't necessarily dispute his account, that is, Comey's account. You can't have both of those true. Where do you stand?
Yeah, I think that lots of reasonable people can have differences about how Jim Comey navigated the unprecedented complexities of the 2016 election cycle. But I think Jim Comey is a fundamentally honorable guy, and I have lots of problems with the timing of his dismissal. And I'm sure Bob Mueller will be diving into almost all of those issues.
Well, Washington, D.C. and Maryland just announced this morning that they're suing President Trump. They're alleging that he's in violation of anti-corruption clauses in the Constitution, essentially because he's retained ownership of his company and accepted millions of dollars in benefits from foreign governments since he's become president. Do you have a position on this?
Yeah, I saw a headline to that effect as I was just walking into the studio. I live in Nebraska, and I commute almost every week. So I'm in D.C. for the voting week. So I haven't seen any particulars on those stories, so I can't add much value there. But I saw that over the weekend, it looked like the Department of Justice is putting out some opinion which draws a distinction about traditional business operations being paid and potentially being paid by foreign sources versus traditional bribery statutes. I want to dive into that, but I haven't looked at any of those details.
So you do have concerns about President Trump's business interests?
I have lots of concerns about the Trump Organization's complexity. I think it's important for a president of the United States to be focused on his day job serving the American people. We have the term public servant for a reason. And so I think there are lots of good reasons why these statutes have been put in place historically. And I look forward to looking at the DOJ opinion that came out over this weekend.
We're talking to Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse, the author of The Vanishing American Adult, Our Coming-of-Age Crisis and How to Rebuild a Culture of Self-Reliance. He's senator from the state of Nebraska. I've got to ask you, Senator Sasse, where you stand now on the president in general, because certainly during the campaign you were one of the lone Republicans who spoke out. He called you a gym rat, I believe, but you said, you know, that he was maybe somewhat megalomaniacal, and you were strong in your language. You said there was a creepy, tyrannical streak in him and all the rest of that. Still pretty much stand behind that, or have you come around, as many Republicans have, to realizing maybe there's pragmatic reason to support him?
Well, I have lots of differences with this president and happy to unpack those with you. But first, let's just linger on Jim Rat for a second. As the son of a Nebraska football and wrestling coach, where I'm from, Jim Rat is high praise. So when the president decided to unleash his guns on me and call me a Jim Rat, my wife was more than a little perplexed. My wife's joke was, you have bad hair, bad teeth, no fashion sense, and no rhythm. Why would he attack you in a way that you'll embrace? So I'm here to happily embrace the Jim Rat put down. But my view...
It's a lot better than low energy Jeb or, you know, crooked Ted Cruz or whatever.
Yeah, no one calls me low energy. I would say that as a conservative, by which I mean a Tocquevillian localist, I believe that the world is mostly about persuasion and about love and about local community and neighborhood and family and entrepreneurship and free assembly and free association and great dinners and neighborhoods. When you have that view of the world, I want as few one-size-fits-all national solutions as possible. That's what it means to me to be a conservative. I'm the third or fourth most conservative guy in the Senate by voting record, but I'm not very partisan. I'm one of five people in the Senate, I think, who's never been a politician before doing this. I was a business guy and then a college president before I came here. So I'm skeptical of the consolidation of power, period, full stop, regardless of who the individual is. Anybody who's the president should be viewed with skepticism by the other branches of government. That's why our founders divided power in so many different ways. They divided it vertically and horizontally. They divided it in the sense that the Ninth and Tenth Amendment tried to derive as much power as possible to states and local governments. And in D.C., we distinguish between among the three branches, but especially between the legislative and the executive branch. So I'm skeptical of anybody who's in the office of president, regardless of whether they're in the same office, same party with me or not. Obviously, it's less and less clear what the Republican Party really stands for in terms of a prioritized issue set. But I try to go issue by issue. So there are a number of issues that will come before Washington, D.C. or before the Congress this year. And on lots of them, the president and I will be aligned. But I think what we should recognize is that mostly D.C. is not dealing with the big policy challenges of our time. If you wanted to rank order the really big three or four or five things, what's it going to look like in a world with shorter and shorter duration jobs? What happens in a world where national security and global security are more and more driven by cyber events and cyber attacks, where the line between state targets and civil society targets is grayer? If you want to think about the entitlement crisis we face, there are lots of issues we should be tackling, and Washington's not. We're dealing with a much smaller set of those, and on those I'm more often aligned than disaligned with this president right now, or misaligned. But fundamentally, I try to go on a case-by-case basis as we tackle the issues.
Well, let's talk a bit about health care, because you've gone on record as saying that Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, was the worst law in our history, and there are a lot of people who supported President Trump and who supported Republican candidates who are going to, presumably, with whatever's going to replace the Affordable Care Act, be off the rolls. I'm not only talking about Medicaid, I'm talking about people who have all sorts of difficulties, including previous conditions and the like. How does taking people's health care away turn out to be good for neighborhoods and communities?
Yeah, fair question, but let's pause for just 1 second. You're attributing a quote to me there that I certainly don't recognize. So this worst law in our history stuff that you're citing, I don't know what that comes from. I'm happy to explain why I think Obamacare exacerbated far more problems than it solved. But I think the more interesting question is understanding why American healthcare was broken in 2008-09 and why it needed reform. So I am very critical of Obamacare, but it's totally insufficient for people in my party to simply be anti-Obamacare. We have to explain what we're for. And what we should be for is a healthcare system that yields greater portability across job and geographic change. Because one of the big, broad public misconceptions about American healthcare, and obviously there are lots of problems, right? There's a quality management problem, there's an uninsurance and underinsurance problem, and there's a premium problem. If you look at those last two, most of the American public is far more concerned with the increasing costs of healthcare and the premium growth than they are with the uninsurance problem. But I think they're both mega problems we should face. But just looking at the uninsurance problem, there's broad public misunderstanding of what is driving it. So when you survey the public, most people think that we have growing uninsurance in America over the last 20 or 30 years, primarily because of poverty or because of health status. People think that it's socioeconomics or it's pre-existing medical conditions. That actually isn't true. By far the largest driver of growing uninsurance in America is job change. Average duration at a firm as recently as the mid-1970s was 2.5 decades. Today, average duration at a firm is less than 4 years. And every time people change jobs, they tend to go through a period of uninsurance that lasts 4 to 6 months. Well, that's a crisis, because when you go through that job change of half a year every fourth year, that may be when you get the breast cancer diagnosis. That may be when you have the car accident. And now you become a part of the new pre-existing conditions population that can't get insured 3 and 5 and 10 years from today. So I think it's really important for us to distinguish between today's pre-existing conditions population, which is probably on the order of 3.5% of the public, or about 10 million people out of the 320 million of us, and the increasing pre-existing conditions population 5 and 10 and 15 years hence, which is in the tens of millions and driven almost entirely by shorter duration jobs. So what I'm in favor of is creating a health insurance system where there's portability, where people buy the policies that they want that can go with them across job and geographic change. Most of that problem wasn't really tackled by Obamacare. Obamacare is mostly a Medicaid expansion. So if you look at the folks who are newly insured under Obamacare, most of them are folks between 100 and 133% of the federal poverty line, which is roughly households making between $21,000 and $28,000 a year. And that doesn't actually create long-term portability for people once they get employed again. So I think there's a lot about Obamacare that's wrong, and I'd be happy to parse that if we had all day, and I know we're getting on to other topics. But I think the more critical point is to recognize, why did we need American healthcare reform in 2008-09, and we didn't do enough to address that? That's what we should actually be fixing today.
Again, we're talking to Republican Senator Ben Sasse. Just for the record, Senator, the quote comes from Mother Jones Magazine, but it may be wrong, but that's where it came from. I mean, you're saying that this is the worst law in our history. I wanted, actually, as I said earlier, to talk with you about...
Yeah, Michael, I really don't want to be argumentative, but I just want to put on the record, that is not my quote. So I don't know where you're getting that, but if we were going to talk about worst laws in American history, I'd be talking about racial stuff. So Obamacare as the so-called worst law in history, and that's not from me.
All right, well, if we got it wrong, it's our apology, but as long as you brought up race, you probably should have said something when Bill Maher brought up the N-word, huh?
Yep, I should have. You know, I was out talking about how you rebuild the culture of self-reliance. And bizarrely, we were talking about how important it is for our kids to have experiences with manual labor growing up. And where I'm from, almost every kid grew up being bussed out into the fields to, it used to be walk beans. Most of those jobs have been overtaken by technology. And to tassel corn. And Bill Maher was making some random joke about how he'd never been to Nebraska. So I invited him to come work in the fields with us. And he decided to go from there to using the N-word. And I was, you know, completely stunned and cringed and froze and left the studio and got on a red eye and tossed and turned all night trying to sleep and got up and decided to tweet out what I wish I'd have said in the moment because I'm a historian by training. Again, I told you I was a business guy and college president by most of my work history, but I'm trained as an academic historian. And the N-word is a unique assault on universal human dignity, which is part and parcel of the American idea. So absolutely wish I'd argued with him in the moment.
But you also said you're a First Amendment absolutist, which means, I presume, that you're okay with hearing the N-word or that it should be said and not be seen as hate speech or heard as hate speech?
No, it means the government shouldn't solve every problem. That's what it means to be a First Amendment absolutist. It means that we believe the beating heart of the American idea is free speech, press, religion, assembly, and protest. And it means most of the really interesting things in the world can't be solved by compulsion and by power. And so government shouldn't try to solve every problem. But neighbors should absolutely argue and wrestle on the big and important topics in American life. And this is one of them.
Well, this gets right to your book, and your book is really about what it means to be an adult, and there's a lot of poor mentoring. There's also the sense of a kind of long adolescence. They used to call that the Peter Pan syndrome or something along those lines, young people not maturing and not really coming into the adulthood that you define in the book. I'm just wondering to what extent this has to do with the millennial generation themselves and getting comforted and being maybe too materialistic and too consumer-oriented, as you intimate, or the lack of the older generation to really place those values in a strong way into circulation among young people.
Yeah, great, great distinction. So first of all, the book is a constructive project. The Vanishing American Adult is about trying to think together about what kind of habits we want our kids to have as they transition from the dependent state of childhood to the independence of adulthood. And we don't have a lot of context or venues for people to wrestle through these things together anymore. Local community is being hollowed out. There's lots of sociological literature on what's happening to local community. But our national conversations are increasingly political. And most of the stuff that matters in sort of trying to help a 10-year-old become a 12-year-old, become a 14-year-old, become a 16-year-old isn't about compulsion. It's about your habits and it's about your affections and it's about your loves. And I like your term a lot of the Peter Pan syndrome. Because I don't think that many of us remember, since Disney has remade Peter Pan, Peter Pan was a dystopian hell. Peter Pan wasn't meant to be a utopia. It's a bad thing to be stranded in this state of perpetual adolescence. Peter Pan becomes bodily an adult. He's ultimately strong enough and willful enough that he's killing people, and yet he has no historical memory. He doesn't even remember the names of the people that he kills. He's just not interested in it. And I think it's a really useful way to start to part what's wrong with perpetual adolescence versus the gift of actual adolescence. Adolescence is kind of a special thing. It's a concept that's only about 2 millennia old, and it's the idea that you hit biological adulthood, you hit puberty, and yet we don't assume you immediately have to become a fully formed, fully independent adult economically or in terms of education or school leaving or morally or emotionally or in terms of household structure. Adolescence is the idea that you get this sort of 18-month to 4-year period where you get to gradually have greenhouse protections as you transition from dependence to independence. It's a pretty special thing, but only if you recognize it as a means to an
an end. And one of the things that's happening right now, and again, this book, The Vanishing American Adult, is constructive. It's not a blame-laying book. This is not a, you know, old man screaming, get off my lawn. This is not what's wrong with millennials today. It's a cultural conversation to say, what happens when a civilization both has insulation from work as you come of age and have enough total wealth that it becomes harder and harder to see the difference between 10-year-old, 15-year-old, and 20-year-old behavior? I think that's where we have a lot of our kids stranded right now, and it's a big cultural challenge that I think a lot of parents want to wrestle through.
No, you also have some prescriptions, and as a former college president, it seems that you take an interest in the importance of giving kids hard work, giving them chores, giving them a work ethic, giving them that sort of sense of purpose that they can believe in, but also limiting the media corruption. And I think you make a good point about hostage taking hold of young people with computers and mobile devices, taking hold of their attention particularly. How do you stave that off? How do you arrest that?
Yeah, great. So I think five of the habits that help define coming of age are discovering and learning and sort of earning a work ethic, learning how to limit your consumption and why you want to have these sort of softly stoic experiences in life where you have limited consumption, learning how to travel. And that doesn't mean sort of, you know, yuppie, inherited wealth, European travel. It means going to a different neighborhood than where you were raised so you can see life that's organized in different ways. It's about learning to have intergenerational relationships. And it's fundamentally about becoming appetitively literate, not merely functionally literate. All of those things, or most of those things, might have moments where digital tools are helps and means. Obviously, there's aspects of modern travel where, you know, I'm addicted to Waze when I'm driving somewhere. I want to not have to sit in traffic if I could get off at this exit and get back on at the next one. There are ways that certain digital tools can be useful for certain kinds of literacy and functional, appetitive literacy when you're carrying an iPad with you instead of every book when you are traveling. But most of what's important about coming of age isn't really augmented by more and more digital addictions. And I think we need our kids to be able to wrestle through that distinction between when digital tools are helpful means to an end and when they become dangerous distractions that actually become the end in themselves. We need our kids to feel in their belly the difference between going to the top of a mountain by looking at some friend's Instagram pictures of the top of a mountain and actually hiking to the top of a mountain.
Well, we're on the same page, so to speak. You want kids to not only have the experiences, but also to read books. And you're talking about a pretty high bar when it comes to books, if I may say so, especially since, as you point out, the younger they are, the less they're reading now. And that has a lot to do with the devices. But I'm coming up on a break, and I want to give listeners an opportunity to join this conversation. In fact, we've been talking about politics and talking about the new book that Ben Sasse has out and available. He's senator from Nebraska. The book is called The Vanishing American Adult. We do welcome your involvement in this program, and you can join us at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Welcome your call, so please give us a ring. It's 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You can also, of course, let us know what your thoughts are or any questions or comments you might have by going to our Facebook page. Again, our guest is Senator Ben Sasse, U.S. Senator from Nebraska, Republican, author of The Vanishing American Adult, Our Coming-of-Age Crisis, and How to Rebuild a Culture of Self-Reliance. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Senator Ben Sasse, who joins us from the nation's capital. He's Senator of Nebraska, Republican Senator, who's written a book about American virtues, family values, and also about really the crisis of civic engagement and the loss of shared American values and American virtues and the need for self-control and self-sufficiency, particularly among our young people. The book is fairly wide-ranging. It's by someone who has a PhD in history and also is a former college president as well as now a first-term American senator. Let me bring our callers in, and let's go right to our first caller. Doug, you're on. Morning.
Yes, Senator Sasse bemoans a crisis of public trust and an adolescence in the way that we approach many things in our society. it would be great to hear Senator Sass restore public trust and move away from an adolescent point of view regarding policy by promising not to vote for health care reform that would take away health care insurance from 20 million people without any committee hearings, with very little time for the public to discuss an extraordinarily important public issue. He's part of a Republican caucus in the Senate that is proposing to just drive this through with almost no public ability to respond to what's going on. And I feel very strongly about this issue, and it's really important that public trust be restored in this area.
A lot of people see it that way. Senator Sass, let's hear from you.
Yeah, Doug, thanks for your comments. So let's put this in a little bit broader historical context. I don't think that we have tackled the big healthcare reform issues before 2009-10. And then in the passage of Obamacare, it passed, or the Affordable Care Act, whichever your preference is, passed on Christmas Eve of 2009 in one body and then March in the other body of 2010. It wasn't implemented until January of 14, so it's been implemented for right about 3 years right now. And most of the stuff that Leader McConnell is proposing, again, the House bill is what I think Doug is probably citing. The House bill is not the basis of what Leader McConnell, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, is proposing in the Senate. But what McConnell is proposing would have a 3 to 4 year transition plan. I have not seen the details of what McConnell wants, and I am, I think, partly aligned with Doug in wanting to have lots of broad public understanding of what is ultimately going to be proposed this round. But a 3 to 4 year transition plan is not the same thing as the kind of cliff that I think Doug might be envisioning, which is sort of based on media accounts of a House bill that is not the basis of what we're doing. Okay, that's a lot of technical legislative history.
Well, Senator Sass, excuse me, let me thank Doug for the call. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. But I'm wondering what your take is on I'm reading in Politico this morning, for example, and a number of other political analysts are saying that because President Trump is having so much difficulty now in terms of trust and credibility, it's put him in the thrall of Republican Congress. It's made him much more answerable to Republican Congress, so they would not necessarily go ahead with any kind of impeachment or obstruction of justice pursuits and just get what they want.
Yeah, I wish it were clearer what the Republican Congress actually wanted. So first of all, I think it's worth backing up and putting this transition against the backdrop of previous transitions, because what the Congress has before it is a pileup of the kind of big work that should have been done around here for decades, depending on how you want to calculate it. We haven't done real tax reform in the Congress since 1986, so that's 31 years. We haven't revised national security strategy since the end of the Cold War, which was in 1989. The Soviet Union came apart in 1991, so that's 26 or 28 years, depending on how you count. When President Obama was transitioning in after the 08 election, there was kind of a big public debate. You may remember that Rahm Emanuel, who was then an outgoing congressman from Illinois but was going to be the incoming White House chief of staff, they had a big debate about whether in the Obama transition they could tackle only one big thing or two big things. And then, so there was a debate, one or two, and they let out a menu of four candidates: the stimulus spending bill, Dodd-Frank or financial regulatory reform, cap and trade or climate change legislation, and healthcare reform, which became Obamacare. And they had that big debate about whether or not you were going to do one or two of the big things out of that list of four. On the incoming Trump team, there obviously wasn't a lot of public deliberation about what their legislative priorities were. And I'm, again, not hiding the fact, I know your audience is primarily liberal, I'm not hiding the fact that I'm one of the three or four most conservative guys in the Senate by voting record. But what that means to me is not partisanship. It means that I'm for decentralized solutions where possible. I would like to have less 50-state, one-size-fits-all solutions from Washington, and where possible, a devolution of some of these conversations back to states and localities. But that would require the political parties to tell you what their 5 and 10 year agendas are. And we didn't have a 2016 election cycle that was really fought on the basis of these issues. So I don't think it's as simple as saying the sort of Trump version of a legislative agenda and the congressional Republican version, one gains power and one loses power because of a negotiation about all this other stuff. I think the city is filled with people that don't have any long-term vision. I'd like us to be talking about what it looks like when you take cyber seriously in the 5- and 10-year purview, because our national security strategy needs to change. I'd like to recognize portability, not just of healthcare, but thinking more broadly about educational and mid-career job retraining benefits when average duration at a firm changes. I'd like to see these parties compete, not to be the lesser of two evils of who's more distrusted, but to have the better option for how to tackle the challenges of 5 and 10 years out. And I don't think this city has a whole lot of vision right now.
Well, Senator, you said you didn't want to get argumentative about that quote, and I apologize if we were wrong on it, but we did find the source of the disputed comment. It's from one of your 2014 campaign ads. Let's hear it.
Look, Obamacare is arguably the worst law in our history, but it's been 4 years since it was passed, and Republicans still haven't offered an alternative.
You want to comment, Senator Sass?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. I appreciate that. So arguably, sort of thinking about this on the fly, but thank you for presenting it. Certainly wasn't meaning to suggest that it was the worst law. Absolutely not. That would be Jim Crow, institutionalized racism, or the Fugitive Slave Act. What I'm meaning to suggest is that this is a macro transformation of our entitlement system, and it's not going to tackle the problems that it was purporting to tackle. And so, again, that was, I guess, probably a 2013 moment. Obamacare wasn't even implemented until 2014. You may remember that President Obama's promises about what Obamacare was going to accomplish included it was going to reduce premiums $2,500 per family. In point of fact, Obamacare has raised premiums about $3,100 per family. So it was a $5,600 delta per family in America. Most of the growth of insurance was supposedly going to be on the exchanges. In fact, most of it is just an expansion of Medicaid. So what I'm meaning is we should be having an argument about how we actually repair the, you know, atrophying entitlement state of the 1960s, not merely extending it. But I appreciate you playing that.
Why not repair Obamacare as opposed to gutting it? You got a lot of people who are disabled and, you know, who are dependent on it now. It may have been a mistake to begin with, but now you have this dependency, and maybe from a conservative standpoint, it's not necessarily good, but there are people who are really in terrible pain.
Yeah, and
opioid epidemic to add to that. I mean, yeah.
Sorry. Great point. The opioid crisis is breathtakingly painful, as you see how rapidly it's growing right now. And obviously, lots of the growing population on Medicaid are single males, and a lot of the costs in some Rust Belt states, I think now the estimates are more than 50% of the expenditures for the Medicaid expanded population are opioid population. So I completely agree with the premise, I think, that you're offering, Michael, which is that we want a robust social safety net. I want us to, at the same point, distinguish between what the core problem is in American healthcare and then the welfare problem. Because when you talk about opioids and Medicaid expansion, we're mostly talking about how could we have a functioning social welfare safety net. I applaud that goal. That's a different thing than trying to transform the sort of median American population into folks that require an entitlement to be able to get insurance. We should ask the question, why is there so much growing on insurance, even in the sort of lower middle class and middle class healthy population? And that has to do with premium growth, which is fundamentally based on the tax accident from the 1940s that has most Americans who are not on government programs getting their insurance through a tax benefit that only large firms get, and that Nebraska farmers and ranchers and small business people and job changers don't get. And so I want us to be having the conversation about the distinction between the social welfare safety net programs that you're talking about, and absolutely, we are not and should not throw those people off. And at the same point, we should be solving the real problem we face, which is most families can't afford a middle-class health insurance plan that goes with them across job and geographic change, because we don't really have a lot of insurance. We have a whole bunch of employer-sponsored benefits that try to launder through a tax accident. So you get your insurance through your employer, when most people, I think, would prefer to have a policy that goes with them even when they change jobs or change geographies.
Again, we're talking to Republican Senator Ben Sasse, senator from Nebraska, author of The Vanishing American Adult. And let me bring a caller on from I had a North Carolina caller. I'm sorry, I disconnected you. Please call back. Let me go to Walnut Creek. Ramona, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello. I just wanted to tell the senator that I agree with what he's trying to say about self-reliance and teaching this to our children. And going forward, I'd like him to use an example that's very prevalent here in California, a model for self-reliance, and that is from our undocumented immigrant community. There is no one more self-reliant than the fellow who go gets a lawnmower and goes around and wants to mow your lawn, and the woman who goes and scrapes together money to buy a vacuum cleaner and a mop and wants to clean your house. And, in fact, ironically, they are doing the jobs that the adolescents of the 50s and 60s used to do. They used to help their parents around the house. And I ask an 8-year-old daughter of one of these gardeners who was coming and helping her father mow lawns in the summer, "Oh, wow, that's nice of you to help Daddy. How much does he pay you?" And her response to me was a kind of puzzled look and said, "I don't do this for the money. I do this so my father won't be so tired."
All right, Ramona, let me thank you for the call. I think we get the pith of what you're saying here, and it's an important point about refugees or immigrants having the work ethic that you're lauding here, Senator Sass.
Hear, hear. Ramona, thanks for your impassioned comments. I am with you in believing we want to celebrate hard work and celebrate scar tissue wherever we find it. We are a nation of immigrants, and immigrants are entrepreneurs by nature, right? Immigrants are people who were in one circumstance and decided to go and try to find a better life. And so, you know, this book is 100% not about politics. It's 99% not even about policy. The Vanishing American Adult has a little bit of policy. It's mostly about education and the transition between K-12 and higher ed or training schools and what sort of mid-career job training looks like. But fundamentally, The Vanishing American Adult is about a lot of the cultural issues that Ramona's talking about.
You know, a number of people have pointed this out. Excuse me, Senator Sass, that you've written, you maybe have political ambitions. In fact, I think it was your fifth grade teacher who said you wanted to be president of the United States. But usually that's launched with a book all about policy. And this is a book, in fact, it's very personal. You write about your daughter and work that she does, your children being homeschooled and all the rest of it. Nevertheless, there is a lot of policy implicit in what you're saying here. Values do connect to policy and policy to values.
Values and policy definitely connect. I want to be clear for the record here. My lifelong ambition, not just in fifth grade, but now as a 45-year-old who realizes the dream is probably slipping away, but my lifelong ambition is to be the offensive coordinator for the Nebraska Cornhuskers football team as the son of a football coach.
You mean that's not likely in your future?
I told Nebraskans.
Jim Rat that you are?
When I got elected in 2014, I told Nebraskans, I have no commitment anxiety about my wife or kids, but a 6-year job commitment. I wanted to make sure the public knew that I was on record that if the athletic department called from Lincoln, I would be out of here in a heartbeat to go be a grad assistant on the offensive staff.
But we should also say that what prompted this book in many ways was the decorating of a 20-foot Christmas tree also, maybe talk about your daughter wanting air conditioning, a couple of things along those lines which seem to get away from the work ethic, although I couldn't help thinking 20-foot Christmas tree, that's pretty high and dangerous to get up to.
Yeah, Michael. So there is an anecdote that opens The Vanishing American Adult about how I was a new college president. I was a 37-year-old. I was a business turnaround guy. Again, I was a historian, so it wasn't totally odd that I was called to lead a college, but it was pretty atypical to be 37 and asked to be a college president. And it was not because anybody thought I knew anything about student life or student culture or student experience, but it was because this 130-year-old liberal arts college that I was called to lead in Nebraska was going through a financial crisis, and they were in danger of potentially going bankrupt. And I was a turnaround guy. It wasn't student culture that led me to be called to it. And yet that was what kept me up at night my first many weeks and months on the job, is that we had so many students arriving at the school who had basically just never had any work experiences. This is a different thing for 17 and 18-year-olds in America today than 20 or 40 or 60 years ago, or almost eternity past in almost every civilization under the sun. And again, none of the purpose here is to beat up on millennials. It's to recognize that they're being
being raised at a different kind of time and place in human history. Obviously, we've had an economic bump since 2008, but fundamentally, our kids are still, and this is, you know, a broad socioeconomic range of American kids, are still growing up in the richest time in the richest place in human history. And one of the consequences of that is that they've mostly grown up with enough labor-saving technologies around home that there just isn't a lot of work for them when they're growing up. And so most of our children and grandchildren don't have a feeling in their belly of the distinction between production and consumption. And even of consumption, there's a failure to distinguish clearly between needs and wants. And so you flag, Michael, that at the beginning of the book, my wife and I talk a lot about the sort of silly idea that our kids had one night when the air conditioning was broken in our house, that they needed air conditioning as opposed to the fact that they merely preferred or wanted air conditioning. And those kinds of things, a republic requires that kind of knowledge. A republic requires that you understand the distinction between production and consumption, because it isn't just Aristotle, it isn't history, or it isn't just philosophy and theology that tells people that they're more satisfied when they're living a life of gratitude by trying to do something productive that benefits their neighbor.
Yeah, but there's a lot of kind of Calvinist work ethic in this. And, you know, you were the president of a Lutheran college. You got the Lutheran out of Midland in terms of its title. But there's a good deal of Christian work ethic in what you essentially, if you forgive me for choosing these words, are preaching. And I'm wondering how this translates again to all of the Christian and evangelical support for Donald Trump. I mean, it's a man who was married three times and known for philandering and the like. Yet he goes to Liberty University and gets extraordinary support. How does that equate in your mind?
Yeah, I do think that I think we have two different sociological things happening at the same time, and it's hard to parse them. But I think what's happening is, as we transition from mostly sort of neighborhoods and traditional, let's call them industrial jobs, to this modern, mobile, placeless, digital, suburban, exurban economy, we have a decline of neighborliness. And we could parse that, because I think there's an analog in American history. When people migrated across the seas to American cities between 1870 and 1920, or when they migrated across the landscape, being pushed from the countryside and pulled to the cities, there was a broad panic in America. And this was a bipartisan panic. Republican Teddy Roosevelt, Democrat Woodrow Wilson, almost everything that spawned the progressive era, there was a panic that neighborliness and transparency and accountability and virtue, which of course is a moral term, but virtue also has the Latin root for strength, right? It isn't just a question of morality, it's also resilience. It's sort of deep in your soul scar tissue that becomes the foundation of future character. There was a worry that when you lost the Tocquevillian village, the agrarian village, and you move to cities, that you'd never have neighborliness again. Happily, all those sort of worriers of the late 19th, early 20th century were wrong, because a lot of the social capital and the human networks were recreated in urban ethnic neighborhoods. But what's happening now is the thing that they worried about then, which is our people are more and more placeless. There's a crisis of loneliness in America. There's lots of sociological data that shows the decline of friendship, the decline of deep relationships. And so I think there's a hollowing out of the local, and at the same time, the national conversation is increasingly political. And so we're losing that mediating space for a conversation about all the really important cultural stuff that's upstream from politics, but that a republic, a small r republic, requires, which is we believe in self-reliance, self-discipline, self-restraint, because these things are substitutes for governmental reliance, governmental control, governmental restraint. And right now we don't have a lot of venues for those important conversations.
Well, there's Robert Putnam's book comes very quickly and rapidly to my mind, Bowling Alone.
Let me just underscore that, because I think you're exactly right, Michael. Not just Bowling Alone, but his new book, newer book, Our Kids, is a clear inspiration for a lot of what I'm trying to tackle here in The Vanishing American Adult. The term Our Kids 30, 40, 50 years ago would have clearly echoed in almost all Americans' ears across socioeconomic groups, across racial groups, across geography. Our kids meant all of these people around us in our neighborhood that we have some neighbor love responsibility for. And increasingly, the term our kids echoes in most of our ears just as a privatized term about my actual physical biological progeny. That's a problem. We need a recovery of this neighborliness.
Well, I have to ask you, is Betsy DeVos good for our kids? Because you have come out in support of her, and I know you're in favor of homeschooling for your own kids, but the reality is that charter schools didn't work out so well in Michigan under her aegis.
Yeah, so I think it's really important to distinguish between education and schooling, and that's one of the things that I think is often lost. So I'll make one comment on the political point you're making, but I think the broader point is the more interesting one. Only about 13% of all K-12 funding in America comes from the federal government, and yet when you visit local schools, and that can be in urban neighborhoods in Nebraska or in rural neighborhoods — we don't have a ton of suburbs in Nebraska — but rural places or in Omaha or Lincoln, the vast majority of teachers and administrators and school boards will give you the same sort of worry that more than 50% of all the regulations that tie their hands about local innovation come from the federal government, even though it's only about 13% of the funding. So I think it's really important for us to unbundle those topics. But the more important point is that our kids need to understand schooling as one tool in their education. So my wife is a former public school teacher. I'm a product of public schools in Nebraska. My dad's a lifelong public school teacher. I'm a big proponent of the American public education investment and vision. But it's more critical for us to understand that all of our kids are ultimately hybrid schooled, which is another way of saying they're broadly educated by lots of different institutions. And it's not good for any of us to start to think of their coming of age experience as something that only happens in one homogenized form of the way they spend their time. And yet that is what's happening increasingly to our kids. 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds tend to think of their work — I'm putting that a little bit in scare quotes — tend to think of their work as progression through years or grades in school, and then their time outside of school is just different forms of consumption. That's not the right way to think about it. Most of what's interesting in life is not going to be delivered just by a homogenized form of schooling where we take a bunch of kids through their teenage coming of age years and have them sit primarily immobile, passively learning inside in one kind of institution. Again, I'm a big proponent of American public education, and yet we should recognize that schooling is only one piece of all that happens broadly in the coming of age experience of our kids.
And again, we're talking to U.S. Senator Ben Sass, Republican from Nebraska, author of The Vanishing American Adult. Let me go to some listener questions coming in by email. Here's Chris, who says, do you have a problem with the timing of Comey's firing or the fact of Comey's firing?
Yeah, so I have particularly a problem with the timing. People can make arguments about whether or not Director Comey made the right decisions in 2016, where he ultimately arrogated to himself some decision-making responsibilities that belong to the Attorney General. I want to say that I think that Jim Comey is a very honorable public servant. I think he's a fundamentally trustworthy guy, and he's been reaffirmed by Republican and Democratic administrations multiple times because he's broadly understood to be a trustworthy kind of Elliot Ness-like guy. But that we distinguish between investigative functions and prosecutorial decision-making in the American Jewish jurisprudential system. And so what happened with Jim Comey in 2016 is he ultimately took to himself some decisions that properly belonged to the main Justice Department, not to the FBI. So reasonable people, again, in both political parties, can argue about whether or not Comey made decisions that were problematic. That's completely different than the timing of his firing. The FBI director has a 10-year term for a reason, and when he's involved in investigating the president and the president's associates or the president's campaign and the president's business organization, whatever all those lines and limits were about where the investigation was before Comey was fired and what's been handed off to Bob Mueller, if you think that we have a crisis of public trust, as I believe and as I think the data clearly shows, goes when you have major institutions in American life with 9 and 12 and 15% public approval. That's not a sustainable way to conduct operations of a republic. We need to have the public believe that most of what's important and interesting and meaningful in life isn't done by government. And of those things that are done by government, you, the public, can trust that you're delegating certain limited authorities to people in Washington, D.C., who work for the public good and the public trust.
Well,
and so when there's an investigation like that, a firing in the midst of it is obviously highly problematic.
A lot of our public finds highly problematic what went down here this morning with you. Let me just read you a couple of comments and get your response. Lanny, for example, writes, "Irony, the man talking about self-reliance and maturity dissembles when caught in an outright lie." Rick writes, "After hearing Ben Sasse lie about his quote on the ACA, he loses credibility on anything else." You know, these are kind of strong comments, but your response to them.
Yeah, I mean, the word arguably is a pretty important thing. I thought you were summarizing something that said I had somewhere defined the single worst law in American history as this specific entitlement expansion, and that's not what I said.
We'll leave it as miscommunication at this point. I have to ask you, you're on record as calling for the arrest of Julian Assange. Why?
Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are not a journalistic entity. They're an entity that is widely understood by the U.S. intelligence community to work on behalf of foreign powers against U.S. interests. Obviously, we would get close to classified information in a hurry, so I think we should just leave the line at this. We live in a dangerous world where there are a whole bunch of U.S. spies around the world who do things to protect American interests. You have different illicit programs of state actors and of non-state actors around the globe that try to harm Americans at home and American military folks abroad. And when you have those kinds of spies out there doing the hard work they're doing, if anybody is ever involved in trying to help divulge their information or their whereabouts, that's an enemy and an opponent of the U.S. government.
Senator Sasse, we come to the end of the hour. I thank you much for your participation in the program this morning. And again, remind listeners that Ben Sasse, U.S. Senator from Nebraska, author of The Vanishing American Adult, may be resigning if he hears from the Cornhuskers. But good luck in the Senate ongoing.
Thanks, Michael. Go Big Red. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And we're up ahead of an hour with Joan Williams, who's going to join us in studio as well, distinguished professor of law at University of California, Hastings, and also the author of a book on the white working class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. Stay tuned for that and for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.